Let me tell you what my deep research and basically vision is.
I hope there's Bigfoot. I don't think there is.
I'm not telling you nothing.
The aliens won't let it happen.
Happening now, breaking.
Bernie Sanders is a
Bears beats Battlestar Galactica.
What are the tips? Give me some tips on how to work with Wes Anderson.
Be ready to speak very fast and very clearly, because that's definitely one key thing.
I will only tell the truth. I will only
until you and six kids you barely know in wet bathing suits have surrounded nine chimpanzees outside of a Wendy's. You probably really don't know yourself, okay?
Yep. And we back.
Hello and welcome. You're listening to your new favorite podcast and the best in political, sports, and paranormal news coverage. I'm your host, Wes Anderson, and this is In the Shed. This is episode 007, so whether you're back for more or finding us for the first time this week, hey, thanks for tuning in. It's early Friday morning, March 5th. Not yet light outside, and I am in a shed in the backyard of my home in Alabama, just so I can hang out with you tools and talk about the latest headlines, stories, and rumors in the world of politics, sports, and the paranormal. All right, my tools, here we are, episode 007. As promised, our first ever trash or pass on In the Shed. It's time for me to put up or shut up. Y'all ain't want to believe that your boy got bars, so we gonna find out together. As I said I would, I'm going to spit something real quick to start off our show tonight, and y'all can let me know whether it is fire or should be set on fire. You ready? All right, here we go. Yeah. Shout out to my brother-in-law, Matt Martrat, for the music. All right. Yo. Yo. Look. I'm the type of guy when I'm big mad, grab a pen pad, I just sit back, let it all go, let my thoughts flow, let the ink bleed, hear my soul speak boldly, cause the old me was told he was no good, but I still stood, and I'm still here, and I got skill, and I will kill any instrumental with the click of a Bic or the grip of a number two pencil. Yeah, name another rapper on my level, man, it's not one. These MCs be soft like a man bun. I'ma set it off like a couple of handguns in the hands of Yosemite Sam. I run this game, only got disdain for these little pit stain, bird brain wannabe lanes. They brag about loose change, all sound the same. Mumble rapping, auto-tune rims on the range. I'd rather make sense than make a little change. Refuse to sell my soul for some radio play, but still I ride for my fam like M does for Haley. Six round pick, still the goat like Brady. I'm proud of my bars like a mom and a baby. I'm not Marshall Mathers, but I am Slim and Shady. Bobby said he enjoying and need a couple hearses. I'ma need the crematorium for my verses. Incinerate the beat with ease, and this is my best attempt to show y'all what I'm like when I'm in these streets or on a beat. Yeah, that's all I got. Hey, trash or pass, In the Shed with Wes. That's it, that's all I got. Let me know what you think. Let me know, man. You can get at me and let me know if you loved it or if you hated it, if you are pleasantly surprised with the flow, or does it have to go? Email the show at intheshedwithwes@gmail.com and let me know what you think. I told y'all I was going to spit a few bars for you, that I was a true spitter, so let me know if I am right about that or, in fact, if I am tripping. All right, let's get to some corrections and comments from last week's show. 49 days, Keystone. 28 days, Hanobia. No Bigfoot invites. We're not annoyed. We're not upset. We're not dismayed. Just disappointed. Still waiting. Waiting and disappointed. Whenever you're ready, you can reach the show by emailing us at intheshedwithwes@gmail.com. All lowercase letters, no spaces. Which of you will be first? On last week's show, I joked about prison being a welcome break for parents.
It has since been pointed out to me that prison is in fact not a fun place to be. I am aware. It was a joke. It was a joke. We have previously reported on the perilous nomination of one Neera Tanden for appointment as head of the Office of Management and Budget in the Biden administration. This past week, amid backlash from both the left and the right, Mrs. Tanden has removed her name from consideration for the appointment. And I'm not saying that we deserve the credit, but we weren't wrong. And what we said needed to happen did, in fact, happen. So, good on us. Way to go, tools. Way to go. On last week's show, we laughed at the fact that someone came out their pockets to serenade the house of one Rafael Edward Cruz with the sweet and rhythmic sound of a mariachi band. We are now able and happy to report that the cost of such an endeavor was approximately $650 an hour. Last week, we covered the fact that Seahawks quarterback Russell Wilson, though not asking for a trade, publicly shared the four teams who he would accept a trade to: the Dallas Cowboys, the Chicago Bears, the New Orleans Saints, and the Las Vegas Raiders. On Dan Patrick's radio show this last week, the host suggested Wilson's time in Seattle may be short, and he made the analogy that the situation was akin to a husband telling his wife, "I'm not saying I want a divorce, but if we did get a divorce, I would want to wind up with one of the following four women." I'll give my own analogy, not in regard to Russ, but in regard to the Seahawks. The Seahawks are like the husband that's married to a 10, but doesn't realize it and leaves her for a solid 6.5. Because they don't seem to understand what they have in Russell Wilson, and they're the only ones. They announced yesterday that they're taking calls on him. And finally, India, we love you. We are up to 28 individual listeners in India now, making it our second largest nation in number of listeners by far. In the Shed with Wes may never break through in the United States, but India, we're coming. I want to get my face on a billboard over there. That is my goal. Forget advertisers in America. Companies in India, get at your boy. We're blowing up in India. That's our goal now, and we couldn't be happier about it. Keep spreading the word, India. After the United States and India, our next biggest markets are France, Australia, and Greece. Thank you to all of our listeners, international and stateside. We greatly appreciate your support. Keep sharing our show with your family, your friends, and let's grow this thing together. And as the rain begins to fall on the roof of the shed, you may be able to hear that on your end. We do have three listener emails to read today. The first comes to us from Andrew from Arkansas. Andrew writes, "You're just a Trump hater." Thank you for listening, Andrew, and thank you for writing in. Hate is not something that we do here on In the Shed with Wes Anderson. I keep it a buck with you. We share both the positive and the negative from the administration, no matter who is in office, and we're going to keep on doing it, too. Our second email comes to us from Alex in New Zealand. Awesome. Alex writes, "Hey, Wes, love the show. Is it really actually recorded in a shed? Can you talk about mermaids?" Hey, Alex, thanks so much. Yeah, absolutely. I'm in a shed right now. That's where the show is recorded. I've got a table, a chair, a computer, a microphone, and a 50-foot extension cord. And somehow I'm reaching you in New Zealand, which is pretty cool. How awesome is that? You can tell it is recorded in a shed because sometimes you hear background noise that you would not hear if I were in a fancy studio or even in a soundproof room, like the rain that you may hear shortly, police sirens, or my neighbor's dog barking. So yeah, it's called In the Shed with Wes because I'm Wes and I'm in the shed. So yeah, can I talk about mermaids? Sure. Yeah, why not? We can talk about mermaids on an episode soon. Absolutely. We talk about all kinds of things, paranormal things that may be real or may not, conspiracy theories, politics, sports, all of it. So sure, we can add mermaids to the mix just for you and for our fans in New Zealand. And our final email comes from Patty from Kentucky. Patty says, "Wes, you laugh a lot during the paranormal segments. Are you making fun of the stories, or do you believe that they're true?" Hey, Patty, I appreciate the question, and I must say that I love the state of Kentucky. I have family from there, so it's good to hear from you. We like to keep it light here on In the Shed. That's who we are, ultimately, a lighthearted news show. When it comes to paranormal, I'm a bit of a hopeful skeptic. I do believe in some of it, for sure. I have had some unique experiences myself, a couple of which I've already shared with you. There's other things, stories that we'll talk about, things that I'll share with you that I absolutely do not believe in to be factual, but I at least find them interesting nonetheless. I do believe in some of it I don't, but I find it fun and we like to keep it light on In the Shed. And so that's kind of what we do. That's all our listener emails for this week. If you'd like to share your thoughts about one of our stories, or if you have an email that you'd like to be read on the show, you can email us at intheshedwithwes@gmail.com. That's intheshedwithwes@gmail.com. Okay, enough of that. Let's switch to this. Let's move to the world of politics and let's hit the headlines. From the Daily Mail, ex-New York Times writer Barry Weiss warns Americans are staying silent for fear of being canceled by a liberal zealous cabal. Omar rips COVID relief stalemate, says Trump did more, according to Fox News. Senate Democrats reach deal on extending unemployment insurance, writes Axios. China to tighten grip on Hong Kong elections, says the BBC. From CBS News, accuser claims staffer took harassment training for Cuomo. And finally, a reporter is going to trial over her coverage of Black Lives Matter protests, and that's according to BuzzFeed News. Our first story in the world of politics, NRA to move to Texas, fleeing litigation brought against it by New York State. The National Rifle Association announced Friday its plan to move to Texas, fleeing ongoing litigation brought against it by the New York State Attorney General, who has sought to dissolve the organization for violating its nonprofit status. As part of the move, the gun rights group is also considering closing or shrinking its headquarters, located in Fairfax, Virginia, officials said, emphasizing that no decision has been made. The NRA was chartered in New York State in 1871, but has long had most of its employees based in the Washington area. Last summer, New York Attorney General Letitia James filed a lawsuit that called for the removal of NRA CEO Wayne LaPierre from the leadership post that he held for four decades, saying that he and other officials used the nonprofit group to finance a luxurious lifestyle. LaPierre kicked back at James in making the announcement of the planned move. Obviously, an important part of this plan is dumping New York, LaPierre said in a prepared statement. The NRA is pursuing reincorporating in a state that values the contributions of the NRA, celebrates our law-abiding members, and will join us as a partner in upholding constitutional freedom. The NRA laid out a plan that involves some restructuring, including declaring bankruptcy in Texas, though the organization said Friday it is at the strongest financial position in its history. Chapter 11 proceedings are routinely utilized by businesses, nonprofits, and organizations alike to streamline legal and financial affairs, the gun rights group said in announcing the move. The tactic produced derision from longtime critics. Let's be clear about what's happening here, said John Feinblatt, the president of Every Town for Gun Safety. The NRA, which is losing power and hemorrhaging money, is now filing for bankruptcy in an attempt to escape legal culpability for years of financial mismanagement and illegal self-dealing. This desperate maneuver is de facto admission of guilt. The NRA's Texas-based lawyer, William A. Brewer III, described it differently. Under this plan, the association wisely seeks protection from New York officials who it believes have illegally weaponized their powers against the NRA and its members, Brewer said. The Friday news released from the gun rights group tersely addressed the future of the organization's headquarters in Fairfax. The association will analyze whether a move of its headquarters, now located in Fairfax, Virginia, is in the best interest of its members. In the meantime, the NRA's general business operations will remain in Fairfax, the organization said. The NRA has no immediate plans to move its headquarters, but we have formed a committee that is exploring all of our strategic options, NRA First Vice President Charles Cotton said in a statement emailed to the Washington Post. James issued a response to the NRA plan late Friday. While we review this filing, we will not allow the NRA to use this or any other tactic to evade accountability in my office's oversight, James said, making note of the fact that the gun rights group had filed for bankruptcy as part of the move. The NRA's claimed financial status has finally met its moral status, bankrupt, she said. So a couple things here. One, I had no idea that the NRA has been around since 1871. I was surprised by that. Also, the NRA is based out of New York State. Did anyone realize that the NRA, the the National Rifle Association was based out of New York State. That blew my mind. I saw this article. I thought it was interesting. The NRA doing what so many are doing, and that is fleeing to Texas. Right now, California and New York, both places, Los Angeles and New York City specifically, places that used to be go-to places for tech companies, for business, for nonprofits, places that people were drawn to, and right now they're hemorrhaging people and corporations and businesses amid their handling of the coronavirus, the restrictions placed upon companies and businesses and individuals. People are leaving left and right, and a lot of them are heading to Texas. We're seeing a huge boom in Austin, Texas. That's becoming one of the leading tech places in our country, so that's interesting. I would have thought the NRA was based in Texas. I mean, that's not a surprising thing that they would go to Texas. That seems like a completely logical, total logical thing to do. I think they would be welcomed with open arms in the state of Texas. And underneath those open arms are holstered, legally registered firearms. Get it? NRA. I don't know. I think that obviously gun ownership legally in the United States is a big deal, and it is something that people fight over, whether or not there should be more restrictions placed on gun owners, whether they should make some gun control laws, update the laws that we have on the books. In this instance, it's interesting to me that they are filing bankruptcy while also saying that they're in the best financial state that they've ever been. I know that bankruptcy is a tool that companies use from time to time. Nobody has shown that more than President Trump and his use of filing bankruptcy while also being a billionaire. But yeah, I don't know. I think that nonprofit status is a point of contention in America. How you can have all these corporations and businesses that, while you can argue that they serve the public in some way, their purpose is political or is not charitable. When I think of a nonprofit, I think of a charitable organization. And I think that that could be something that we can move towards in the future, is ensuring that nonprofit organizations have a charitable purpose or charitable means. I think if we could get rid of some of these quote-unquote nonprofits that have political aims, or at least make them pay taxes, make them operate like the businesses that they are, as they're taking in millions and millions of dollars and paying out bonuses to their CEOs of millions and millions of dollars, I think that that would go a long way. So NRA, have fun in Texas. I'm sure that New York does not want you, and I'm sure that Texas does. Our next news story in the world of politics, Goya Foods CEO bizarrely says that Trump is still the actual president in CPAC speech. Goya Foods CEO Robert Unanu? Is that his name? Is that your name, Robert? Is your name Bob Unanu? Unanu. Unanu. I'm going to go with Unanu. Goya Foods CEO Robert Bob Unanu continued to align himself with former President Donald Trump and his election fraud conspiracy theories during a speech at the Conservative Political Action Conference on Sunday, bizarrely claiming that, in my opinion, Trump is still president. It's just an honor to be here, but my biggest honor today is going to be that I think we're going to be on the same stage as, in my opinion, the real, the legitimate, and still actual president of the United States, Donald John Trump, he said on the CPAC stage. Since a July 2020 appearance at the White House, Unanu's loud adulation of Trump, who routinely expressed xenophobic views targeting Latinx communities, prompted ongoing calls to boycott Goya Foods, a New Jersey-based company that makes Latin American food products. Goya's board reportedly voted to censure the CEO in late January after he publicly questioned the legitimacy of the November election, which President Joe Biden won with a majority of the popular vote and 306 Electoral College votes to Trump's 232. The decision meant Unanu will be prohibited from speaking to the media without the board's permission, CNN reported. It's unclear if Unanu sought permission to make the CPAC address, during which he repeatedly and falsely suggested the election results were fraudulent and that Trump had actually won. We still have faith that the majority of the people in the United States voted for the president, he said. I think a great majority of the people in the United States voted for President Trump, and even a few Democrats. Goya Foods did not immediately respond to Huffington Post's request for comment. Prior to the board's decision, Unanu had faced renewed backlash over cable news appearances in the aftermath of the deadly January 6 insurrection on the U.S. Capitol, led by Trump supporters. He claimed on Fox News that media and tech companies want to cancel God, free speech, and American culture, history, and liberty by blocking Trump from social media platforms following months of his discrimination about disinformation about the election. Unanu also said there was a war coming during a Fox Business appearance on the inauguration day. Mr. Unanu, you have a funny name. It is fun to say, and I'm sure that I'm mispronouncing it. Look, man, I don't think that Donald Trump got a majority of the votes. And I don't see how you can claim that with a straight face. I mean, even if the man, let's say that these folks that are claiming that the election was fraudulent, even if you are 100% right, even in that incident, Trump would not have got a majority of the votes. He might have squeaked out a win in the Electoral College. But even when he beat Hillary Clinton, and in the Electoral College, he beat her clearly and emphatically. Even then, he did not receive a majority of the votes. She actually won the popular vote by 2 million votes. So this man is off base. He's saying some things that are dangerous, to talk about a war coming, to say that the president who is in the White House now is not legitimate. It annoys me when people say that on either side. When Trump won and Democrats were saying that he was not the legitimate president and they were doing the whole Russia, Russia, Russia thing, that was quite annoying. And now when Joe Biden wins and people are saying that he is not the legitimate president, that also is annoying. People, just get a hold of yourself. Get a hold of reality. Take a deep breath. It's okay. We have survived every presidency that we have ever had, and I think that we're going to be okay. We keep it a buck with you here on In the Shed. In every presidency, every president, every administration does things that are good and does things that are bad. And there's nothing wrong with supporting your team, but just remember that your squad is not the only Americans that there are. In fact, we are all Americans, and we need both the left wing and the right wing for this bird, this beautiful bald eagle, to soar. All right, so just take a chill pill, Mr. Goya. You are causing your business to lose some business, and that is never a good thing if you are CEO. So I would be careful about the things that you say. Nothing wrong with supporting your man. If you're a Trump fan and you believe in what he believes in, more power to you. But to get up on stage and go a little bit crazy, that man just got excited because the crowd was there. They were cheering for him. And you might need to rein it in just a little bit. Just a little bit. His face was in your windshield. Police, skeptical South Dakota AG, didn't know that he fatally struck a pedestrian. North Dakota investigators were skeptical that South Dakota Attorney General Jason Ravensborg didn't know that he fatally struck a pedestrian on the night of September 12, 2020. According to video footage from two separate interviews between investigators and Ravensburg, made public Tuesday by the South Dakota Department of Public Safety, authorities found the reading glasses of Joe Beaver inside the Ford Taurus that killed him. His face was in your windshield, Jason. Think about that, a detective with the North Dakota Bureau of Investigation said during an interrogation on September 30th. Law enforcement from North Dakota have assisted in the investigation in order to buffer the inquiry from conflict of interest perceptions. The release of those videos comes after articles of impeachment against Ravensburg were filed in the South Dakota House of Representatives on Tuesday afternoon. The articles have been filed only with the Legislative Research Council and were scheduled to be formally introduced on the House floor Wednesday. Authorities announced last week that Ravensburg, 44, would be charged with three misdemeanors in connection to the death of Beaver, the 55-year-old who was walking along the shoulder of Highway 14 west of Highmore when Ravensburg's vehicle left its lane of travel and struck him. South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem called on Ravensburg to resign Tuesday morning. In that statement, she said the state would be releasing additional material from the investigation. "This is not political, and it's not personal," Rep. Will Mortensen said when he filed the articles. "I do not believe Attorney General Ravensburg belongs in prison, but I know he does not belong in the office of the Attorney General anymore." In interview videos totaling roughly 3 hours of footage, Ravensburg gives his account of the fatal incident. Ravensburg, who insisted he wasn't looking at his phone at the time, said he didn't see anything until his vehicle made impact with Beaver. "Quite frankly, wham! The incident happened, Ravensburg said in the interview. Asked if he saw anything after the impact, Ravensburg said he didn't see anything as he was trying to steer the car to the side of the highway, adding he did not know there was a human until the next day. After the collision, Ravensburg said he immediately jumped out of the car and called 911 within seconds. However, an investigator shared phone extraction data from the attorney general, noting that he had logged into a Yahoo email account at 10:20 local 4 minutes before calling 911 to report the accident. He said Ravensburg was on other news sites 1 to 2 minutes before calling 911. The investigator notes there was time between impact with Beaver and when he called 911. So when we look at that, our concern is everything we are seeing here is it appears that you were on the phone reading political stuff at the time, the investigator said. Part of this, Jason, is we have a job to do, right? People make mistakes. We're thinking that you made one. Ravensburg insists that he didn't use the phone right before the incident, saying he remembers turning off the radio and checking the speedometer right before the collision. Ravensburg said once he got out of the car, he began looking for what he had hit and saw a white pickup truck, which Beaver's family later said Beaver may have been walking back to fix. I did see the white pickup in the ditch at the time, but I didn't put two and two together yet, Ravensburg said in the interview. Hyde County Sheriff Mike Volick reported to the scene, looked at the car and the wreckage, and asked Ravensburg to get his registration and insurance and meet him back at his car, where he wrote out a red ticket to represent insurance company for a deer hit. Ravensburg described leaning in from the driver's seat, trying to avoid glass in the passenger seat as he reached for his registration. He denies seeing the pair of glasses. They're Joe's glasses, so that means his face came through your windshield, an investigator said. Volick offered him a ride or the use of a personal car. Ravensburg recalls that he said, "Whatever works for you, Sheriff." He ended up getting a car. "I continued home," Ravensburg said. An investigator asked the attorney general if he'd seen a flashlight carried by Beaver either before the accident or when he'd walked back toward town while dialing 911. Ravensburg denied seeing it, even though it was pitch black outside. The investigator told Ravensburg the light was still on when they arrived at the scene the next day, and then a witness had also seen Beaver walking with it. Ravensburg said he called his chief of staff, Tim Borman, that night, telling him he thought he had hit a deer. The detectives also questioned how Ravensburg could have searched the area with his cell phone flashlight, at one point walking right by Beaver's body, and not seen him. They pointed out that part of Beaver's white skin was exposed and the flashlight was still on. The detective said it would have been hard to miss both Beaver's body lying in the grass near the highway pavement and a flashlight shining on a dark night. Ravensburg insisted he saw neither and pointed out that the sheriff and the tow truck driver who arrived later also had not spotted Beaver's body or the flashlight. Earlier in the interview, the attorney general told detectives that he had no idea he had killed a man until the next day when he stopped by the accident scene with Borman. He said, "I found the body and I just came to Tim and I said, Tim, you've got to come here. I found a body." Ravensburg told investigators that he and Borman then went and got the sheriff, who later released them from the scene, saying he would call DCI to investigate. The state also released the audio and transcript of the 911 call, the toxicology report, and the state's crash report in October. In the 2-minute, 22-second 911 call made after the crash, Ravensburg told the dispatcher he hit something that was in the middle of the road. Whew, man. Yeah, this looks bad. This looks bad. You've got a Republican state attorney general, the top cop of your state, heading home from a political gathering, and he kills a man with this car. Now, the toxicology reports have come back, and it showed that A.G. Ravensburg was not under the influence of drugs or alcohol. He was not over the legal limit for either. So it does not appear that he was driving while intoxicated. However, the cell phone data that has come out in this case, the fact that the man's glasses were in his car after impact and that it was clear that the attorney general's car left its lane, evidence points to the fact that the man was on his cell phone. You see all the commercials, you see the billboards about not texting and driving, about not reading articles and information on your phone while trying to steer your car. And all evidence points towards the fact that maybe that's what happened in this case. And the reason why we share this, the reason why I thought this was a news story worth highlighting on this week's show, is because this is another, yet another example of someone getting preferential treatment because they hold political office. I don't know about this guy. I've never heard of A.G. Ravensburg before this incident. I don't know what kind of character he has. I don't know his history. I do know that he's the top cop of a state, that he hit a man with his car. The evidence shows that he was on his phone both before and right after, that the glasses of the man were inside the car, that he left his lane, and yet he's still in office? Like, this man hasn't lost his job, let alone been arrested, let alone being charged with a felony. This man hasn't even lost his job yet. Like, what other job, other than being in politics, being the top cop of the state, can you literally kill somebody? It's your fault that the person died, and you don't even lose your job. Now, maybe he will. They did put articles of impeachment forth, but yo, it's been taking a while, and he's not resigning. And the one guy that put forth the articles of impeachment, the state rep, said, I don't think he belongs in jail, but he sure can't be the attorney general. Yo, I think he belongs in jail. If you're driving recklessly, you're on your phone, you leave your lane, you hit somebody and kill them with your car. I'm just saying, my personal opinion, I think you probably belong in jail. I don't care what your job is. I don't care who you are. I don't care what position you have been elected to. You've made a mistake that has snuffed out a human life. It's a big deal. This story should be getting more attention. The way that it's handled, there should be under the microscope. We should pay very close attention to what happens in this case to make sure that it's handled properly. And Mr. Ravensburg, you need to resign immediately. And law enforcement, you need to take a hard look at whether this is in fact a felony, because I don't see how this man just gets some misdemeanor charges. It wasn't intentional. It wasn't on purpose. It wasn't out of anger. It wasn't planned. I get that. But it was the man's recklessness. It was the man's carelessness that led to this other man losing his life unfairly before it was his time, when he was just trying to walk back to his truck to fix it. And that's a problem. We all know how we would be treated in that circumstance. We all know what would happen to us. And the same thing should happen to any politician as well. Our last news story in the world of politics, we're going to take an in-depth look at the wild, wacky life of Tommy Tuberville. Newest Alabama State Senator Tommy Tuberville is someone whose name has come up on the national political scene as of late. Tuberville, the 66-year-old, twice-married former football coach and father of two, has lived quite a wild, wacky life full of high-end accomplishments, but not short on controversy either. Even before being elected to office, Tuberville has always been a politician and remains a bit of an enigma. So who is Tommy Tuberville? How did he rise to the position of senator, defeating a once popular Alabama politician and former U.S. Attorney General? Thomas Hawley Tuberville was born on September 18, 1954, in Camden, Arkansas, to Charles and Olive Tuberville. He is a 1972 graduate of the Harmony Grove High School and went on to play safety for the Southern Arkansas University Mule Riders. Yes, the Mule Riders. In 1976, Tuberville graduated with a BS degree in physical education. Tuberville started his coaching career at Hermitage High School in Arkansas and later became an assistant coach at Arkansas State University. Tuberville then joined the University of Miami as a graduate assistant and left as a defensive coordinator in 1993. During his tenure at the university, the team won 3 national championships. In 1994, Tuberville began his service as defensive coordinator under Coach R.C. Slocum at Texas A&M University, and after one season at A&M, Tuberville made his debut as a collegiate head coach in December 1994 with the Ole Miss Rebels. In 1997, under Tuberville's mentorship, the Rebels delivered their best performance in 5 years, posting an 8-4 record, an Egg Bowl victory over rival Mississippi State, and a Motor City Bowl win over Marshall. While at Mississippi, Tuberville started the successful movement to ban students from waving Confederate flags while watching home football games. During his tenure with the Rebels, Tuberville displayed a penchant for trick plays and for going for it on fourth down, earning himself the nickname the Riverboat Gambler. In 1997, he was named the SEC Coach of the Year. In four seasons at the helm of the Rebels, Tuberville compiled a 25-20 record, but left the school under a cloud of criticism, taking the job at SEC rival Auburn after repeatedly declaring emphatically and publicly that he was not leaving Ole Miss. Tuberville coached Auburn for 10 years, compiling a record of 85-40, taking the Tigers to 8 straight bowl games, beating rival Alabama a record 6 straight times, and leading Auburn to a perfect 13-0 season in 2004, in which the Tigers won both the SEC and the Sugar Bowl, beating Virginia Tech. Though Tuberville established himself as one of the most successful big-game coaches while at Auburn, he also had a reputation for inexplicably losing games to inferior opponents. After an embarrassing 3-game SEC Conference losing streak in 2003, and just 1 week before the Iron Bowl, Auburn Boosters team president and athletic director took a private jet to Kentucky in a secret attempt to hire then-Louisville head coach Bobby Petrino to replace Tuberville. The secret trip was discovered and referred to as Jetgate. Fans rallied around Tuberville, who was able to keep his job at Auburn for 5 more seasons before being fired in 2008 after going 5-7. Tuberville's reward for being fired? A $5.1 million buyout. After being fired by Auburn, Tuberville spent the 2009 college football season as a college football analyst for both Buster Sports and ESPN, and also made a cameo in the Academy Award-winning film The Blind Side. On January 9, 2010, Tuberville was announced as the next football coach of the Texas Tech Red Raiders, replacing fired coach Mike Leach. Tuberville got off to a great start as the head man in Lubbock, going 8-5 in his first season, and becoming only the second coach in school history to win a bowl game in his first season. Tuberville capitalized on his early success by landing the highest-ranked recruiting class in school history, ranking 14th nationally, and seeing a spike in ticket sales. Because of this, Tuberville got a 1-year contract extension and a raise in the process. Unfortunately for Tuberville, that season turned out to be his high point while at the school. In 2010, Tuberville and business partner John David Stroud were involved in a lawsuit filed by investors against the firm TS Capital LLC, accusing them of fraud. Stroud was found guilty and sentenced to 10 years in prison. However, Tuberville settled his case in civil court and did not face criminal charges. In a 2012 game against the Kansas Jayhawks, Tuberville slapped a graduate assistant across the face after his team received a penalty for having too many players on the field, and later that year his wife was involved in a car accident running a red light and striking another car in which an 87-year-old passenger was injured and later died. Mrs. Tuberville was widely criticized in the community and paid a settlement to the man's family but never faced criminal charges. Tuberville coached the Red Raiders for only 3 seasons, compiling a record of 20-17, but wearing out his welcome with alumni, students, and fans. His exit from the university was unceremonious and quite similar to his exit from Ole Miss. While at a dinner with potential recruits and their families, Tuberville excused himself from the table and never returned. Shortly thereafter, it was announced that he had resigned his position at the school and accepted the head coaching job at the University of Cincinnati instead. Tuberville coached Cincinnati from 2013 to 2016, compiling an overall record of 29-22, with his best season at the school being his first. While at Cincinnati, Tuberville gained a reputation as a disinterested recruiter and fundraiser and received wide-sweeping condemnation after being caught on camera after a 20-3 loss to BYU, screaming at displeased fans in the student section, telling them to, and I quote, "go to hell and get a job." After retiring from coaching, Tuberville considered trying his hand in the realm of politics. While considering a run for Senate, Tuberville spent time in Kentucky, Florida, and Alabama trying to ascertain which state would allow him the best chance to get elected. In April 2019, Tuberville made his political debut, declaring that he would run in the 2020 Republican primary for the United States Senate seat in Alabama. Former White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer agreed to assist his campaign, and he was endorsed by then-President Donald Trump, beginning a bus tour traveling to every county in the state, stopping at barbecue joints, coffee shops, and hardware stores for scheduled and impromptu meet-and-greets. Tuberville was running against former U.S. Senator and Attorney General Jeff Sessions, a once-popular politician in the state. While running against Sessions, Tuberville refused to debate his opponent and built a platform around his total support of Donald Trump and his agenda, as well as a hard-line stance on the issue of immigration. The first-time politician's platform did not sit well with many of the coach's former black players who issued public statements expressing their disappointment in the former coach's stances on issues and saying that they had never seen this side of him before. Leading up to the election, Tuberville and Sessions were neck and neck in the polls, which proved to be accurate as the primary resulted in a runoff election between the two candidates in which Tuberville defeated the seasoned politician. After defeating Sessions, Tuberville raised eyebrows during his victory speech, lambasting his opponent rather than congratulating him on a hard-fought race, cursing, and at one point, even putting Vice President Mike Pence on speakerphone. Tuberville then went on to defeat the Democratic incumbent, Doug Jones, who rose to prominence for prosecuting the KKK, winning by a vote of 60.1% to 39.7%. Since being elected to the Senate, Tuberville has wasted little time making headlines, first for seeming to be unable to name the three branches of government while being interviewed for a newspaper profile, for ranting about the necessity of school prayer from the Senate floor, for continuing to offer staunch support for Donald Trump amid his attempts to overturn the election, for promulgating the belief that the election had in fact been stolen from the 45th president, and most recently for claiming to a CNN reporter that he was unaware of the controversial statements and actions of fellow Senator Marjorie Taylor Greene because the bad weather and travel had made it hard for him to check the news. There's no doubt, coach, businessman, and now Senator Tommy Tuberville has lived a wild and wacky life. He's accomplished things that many of us could only dream of, and yet controversy always seems to be on his heels. And, even long before he was ever elected to public office, he was a politician. That's all for the world of politics. Let's switch to this. Let's go to the world of sports, and let's hit the headlines. Creighton suspends head basketball coach McDermott over racially insensitive comments. With virus bans lifted, UFC wants Texas event ASAP. The father of NHL great Wayne Gretzky has passed away. Tom Brady rookie card sells for record $1.32 million. Big Ben restructures his contract and re-signs with the Steelers. Jets GM open to offers on quarterback Sam Darnold. Portland guard CJ McCollum is cleared for practice. Oklahoma State AD Holder to step down after 16 years. Ex-Auburn defensive end Big Cat Bryant joins Gus Malzahn at UCF. And report finds that Coach Les Miles behaved inappropriately toward female student workers while head coach at LSU in 2013. Our first story in the world of sports this week, let's take a look at what's happening in the NBA. So last week I said that there was one snub when it came to this weekend's All-Star game. I said that there was one player who did not make the All-Star team who in fact should have, and that was Trae Young, the Atlanta Hawks point guard. I made one particular statement in that segment that has gotten a lot of, shall we say, backlash, a lot of interest from those of you who heard it. I said, name five point guards better than Trae Young. I'll wait. Well, many of you hit me up in my DMs in the email section and did name five point guards who you thought were better than Trae Young. And so I thought that we would take a look at the starting point guards in the NBA and we would release our In the Shed top 10 point guards in the NBA. So y'all challenge me. Y'all challenge my basketball knowledge. Y'all say your boy don't know what he's talking about. Trae Young is not a top five point guard in the league. Well, let's take a look. And let's start with number 10, Celtics point guard Kemba Walker. I know Kemba Walker has been hurt this year, and since he has returned to the lineup, he has not looked particularly good. He's struggled. He's been one of the reasons that fans have pointed out that the Celtics have struggled and have underperformed. But he started to pick it up as of late. He's starting to round into form. Look, Kemba Walker is a good point guard. He's tough. He can get into the lane. He's a good outside shooter. He does raise the talent and the ability of those around him. And even though he's not having his best year, he is a top 10 point guard in the league, in my opinion. Kemba Walker at number 10. Number 9 on the list, Jamal Murray. Jamal Murray, who had an awesome performance in the bubble last year, helping the Nuggets get all the way to the NBA Western Conference Finals against the Lakers. Jamal Murray looked like he was ascending to superstardom. Hasn't quite made it. Look, Jamal Murray is a good player. He's a wonderful scorer. Doesn't play much defense. And honestly, in ranking point guards, I put him at number 9 for the sole reason of he's not really a straight-up natural point guard. Jamal Murray is more of a undersized two-guard that has been fit into kind of a combo guard position in the league, has been played at point guard. He's not the best passer, doesn't move the ball enough. He's a good player, don't get me wrong, but he's number 9 in the league right now when it comes to point guards. Number 8, y'all gonna hate me for this one. Number 8, Luka Doncic. Yeah, Luka Doncic, number 8. Kind of the same thing as Jamal Murray. Look, Luka Doncic is a better player at this point in his NBA career than Trae Young. I get it. I'm a Trae Young fan. I'm an apologist. I understand Luka is a better player, but we're not talking about who's a better player. We're talking about the NBA point guard rankings. Luka Doncic is a good passer. Luka Doncic is becoming a better shooter. He's not the best defensive player, but he's not a pure point guard. All right, he's not somebody that's going to move the offense. He is a player that can find the passing lanes. He is a player that creates for his teammates, but he's not what I would call a pure point guard. I put him at number 8. Number 7, Kyrie Irving. A lot of people might have Kyrie in the first 2 or 3 when it comes to point guards in the league, and he certainly is if you're talking about talent, if you're talking about scoring ability. But, hey, the truth is that right now he's not even playing point guard on his team. So how can I rank Kyrie Irving as one of the best 2 or 3 point guards in the league when he's not even the starting point guard on his team? He got moved to shooting guard, and his team is better for it. So Kyrie Irving, loads of talent, one of the best scorers, one of the best ball handlers in the league. Again, not much of a defensive player, and definitely not much of a passer. He's at number 7. Number 6, possibly the toughest guy on this list, Kyle Lowry. Kyle Lowry is a point guard that often gets overlooked when you're talking about the top guards in the league. He's a great leader. He has all the intangibles. He started to come up bigger in the playoffs than in years past, the last couple of seasons. He's a big-time performer. He is one of the players that keeps the Toronto Raptors in contention in the Eastern Conference. Without him, I don't think that they would be a playoff team. Kyle Lowry's a tough player, a good shooter. He's at number 6. Number 5, Chris Paul. Number 5, Chris Paul. So again, Chris Paul is someone that you could argue with me about. I had a couple people say Chris Paul is undoubtedly a better point guard than Trae Young. And over the course of his career, he absolutely has been. Chris Paul is a Hall of Fame point guard. He's never done it much in the playoffs, but that's okay. But at this point in his career, we're not talking about a whole career's worth of performances. We're talking about right now, today. Yes, Chris Paul makes his team better. He's got Phoenix in third place in the West right now, which is incredible. He and Devin Booker are a great 1-2 punch. But if I'm starting a team today, if I'm going to take a team today and I'm going to pick one point guard and my options are Trae Young or Chris Paul, I'm going with Trae Young. That's just me. So Chris Paul is number 5. Number 4, Trae Young. Yeah, I said name 5 point guards better than Trae Young. In my estimation, you can. I've got Trae Young at 4. I talked enough about his skill set last week. We don't have to harp on it. This is not a show about Trae Young, but he's the number 4 point guard in the league. Number 3, Dame Dalla. Damian Lillard, the number 3 point guard in the league. What that man is doing in Portland without CJ McCollum this year is incredible. The fact that he's taken that team and he's kept them in the top half of the Western Conference, not just with a 500 record, but a winning record. He's electric on offense. He's a phenomenal shooter, one of the best deep three-point shooters in the league, a great ball handler. And he's clutch, man. He's one of the most clutch players in the league. I watched him play head-to-head with Steph Curry the other night. Steph Curry outplayed him the whole night. But at the very end, even though he was 1 of 8, he came up big, and the Trailblazers won. He's the 3rd best point guard in the league. Number 2 on our list of best point guards in the NBA this year, James Harden. As I said, the Nets aren't even playing Kyrie Irving at point guard. Once they traded for James Harden, they made the decision to put him at point guard, and it's made all the difference for the Nets, vaulting them into 2nd place in the East. They're on a tear right now, winning like 11 of 12 games or 11 of 13 games, and James Harden is playing in MVP form. The man is a walking triple-double. He's leading the league in assists. You think of him as a ball-dominant player, and he tends to be, but with the Nets, he's really keeping things moving. He's finding the open guy. He is their offense. He's keeping Kyrie Irving going, even without Kevin Durant the last month. He's raised the play of everybody around him. James Harden is the 2nd best point guard in the league. I wouldn't have said that a couple years ago. I saw him as another player that's kind of being forced into that role, but he's actually become a real legitimate point guard and a darn good one. And the top point guard in the NBA, Wardell Stephen Curry III. He's the best ball handler in the league. He's the best shooter in the history of the NBA. He's taken a team without Klay Thompson, a team with sometimes as few as 9 guys available, and he's keeping them in playoff contention in a very difficult Western Conference. He's one of the top 5 players in the league, and he is the best point guard in the league. So that's my list: Steph Curry, James Harden, Damian Lillard, Trae Young, Chris Paul, Kyle Lowry, Kyrie Irving, Luka Doncic, Jamal Murray, and Kemba Walker. What is your list? Who would be your top 5 players in the NBA when it comes to the point guard position? Get at me. Let me know where I'm wrong. Let me know where I'm right. Let me know your rankings and what you think. Email me at intheshedwithwes@gmail.com and let us know. Last week we talked about the NBA All-Star Game, and we talked about the players who had been selected for the game. Well, this week, the teams have been selected. LeBron James and Kevin Durant went on TV, and they picked their team's playground style. I love that the NBA does that with the All-Star Game now. And here is the squad that they picked. LeBron James, his starting unit is himself, Giannis Antetokounmpo, Steph Curry, Luka Doncic, and Nikola Jokic. And then coming off the bench, he's got Damian Lillard, Ben Simmons, Chris Paul, Jaylen Brown, Paul George, Domantas Sabonis, and Rudy Gobert. Kevin Durant, who will not be playing in the game, still made selections for his team. His starting 5 is Kyrie Irving, Joel Embiid, Kawhi Leonard, Bradley Beal, Jason Tatum, and his bench looks like this: James Harden, Devin Booker, Zion Williamson, Zach LaVine, Julius Randle, Nikola Vucevic, and Donovan Mitchell. I think that Team LeBron has the best starting 5. I think that Team Durant has the best bench, has the most depth. The All-Star Game is this Sunday. I think that Team LeBron wins, and I'm going to go the other way, and I'm going to say that James Harden or Bradley Beal win the MVP for the All-Star Game this year. One of the things that we look forward to in the All-Star Weekend are the contest, the dunk contest, the skills contest, and the three-point contest. The way things are going to work this year is that the three-point contest and the skills contest will happen before the game, and the dunk contest is going to happen at halftime. That's something new that they're trying. I think that will be a lot of fun. So let's take a look at those contests as well. The dunk contest, this is the first year I can ever remember having a dunk contest where nobody in it is much of a star at all. Some names that you might not even know. The dunk contest will be between Cassius Stanley of the Pacers, Obi Toppin of the Knicks, a rookie there, and Anfernee Simons of the Trailblazers. I got Simons. He's a small guy. Small guys have an advantage when it comes to the dunk contest because their dunks naturally look more impressive. That guy has some hops, and he is my pick to win the dunk contest. We will see if I am right. I think I said dunk contest. That would be a different thing. The skills contest is going to be super interesting. That's going to feature Robert Covington, Luka Doncic, Chris Paul, Julius Randle, Domantas Sabonis, and Nikola Vucevic, as well as Chris Paul. Did I say Chris Paul twice? Yeah, I did, didn't I? That's because he's going to be the winner. That's my pick anyway. I don't think the big men can compete. I think that Julius Randle has a shot. Sabonis, I'm sorry, you don't. Robert Covington, I don't think you do either. Really, in my mind, it comes down to Luka, Chris Paul, and Julius Randle. Julius Randle has a lot more skill than people realize, but I think Chris Paul gets it done. Reps for the point guards. The old man gets the win. And this year's three-point contest is absolutely loaded. Check this out. The three-point contest this year will feature Devin Booker, Jaylen Brown, Steph Curry, Zach LaVine, Donovan Mitchell, and Jason Tatum. And I'm going to go with Zach LaVine from the Chicago Bulls. I think that he gets it done. When Steph Curry has been in three-point contests before, he hasn't quite lit it up. He would be the easy pick, but I don't think that it's going to be him this year. I think it comes down to Devin Booker and Zach LaVine. Jaylen Brown might surprise people. Donovan Mitchell might surprise people. But I'm going to go with Zach LaVine for the win there. Last story when it comes to the world of the NBA, and that's the NBA MVP race. We're halfway through the season, and I think that really we're down to 5 possibilities here. You've got Joel Embiid, James Harden, the Joker, LeBron James, and Steph Curry. Now, Embiid is the front runner for sure. Just the other night, he went for 40-19 against Defensive Player of the Year Rudy Gobert and the Jazz. The Jazz have the best record in the league. The 76ers have the best record in the East, and the 76ers took them to the woodshed in overtime behind the dominant play of Joel Embiid. He hit a turnaround three-point shot, which is impressive for his size. He did it with confidence, and he was going at Rudy Gobert all night. He was going at him all night, and he looked dominant. So he's the front runner for sure. But in my mind, the number two guy, and we said it on the show a few weeks ago, James Harden. I'm not historically a James Harden fan, but I have enjoyed watching the man play for the Nets. Watching him play with a more talented roster, with a roster where he can be the guy that sets the table for those around him rather than being the focal point all the time, where he's freed up a little bit, has been incredible. As I've said, he's leading the league in assists, which is quite the accomplishment for him. I think he's done that once before. Look, we're the first ones to talk about it. 2 weeks ago on the show, we said, look out for James Harden. If he continues playing at this level, if the Nets continue with their success the second half of the year, he may emerge as an MVP candidate. And it seems like people are starting to say that. People are starting to realize what we have already realized. So you need to pay attention to what we say on In the Shed, because, Shouty, we locked in. We know what's happening, and we gonna keep it real. Another thing that happened when it comes to James Harden, I saw this week, and this was hilarious and strange and funny. Have you heard about the conspiracy theory going around with James Harden? So one reason that people want to leave him out of MVP discussion, that they don't want to consider him, some of these purists, is because of the way things ended for Mr. Harden in the city of Houston. He didn't want to be there, and he forced his way out. And in order to do so, he had to not care, right? So he sort of phoned it in. He showed up. He skipped part of training camp. He showed up out of shape, overweight. He played lethargically. If we're being real, he quit on his team, yo. And so a lot of people don't want to even consider him for MVP because at the beginning of the season, he quit on his team. I'm looking more at the play with the Nets and how he's playing now. He's playing better than just about anybody in the league, and I think that that's what the MVP is about. And so that's why I consider him. But, yo, it's a conspiracy theory about his time with the Rockets that I have just learned of that is absolutely insane. There are people online who believe with all of their hearts, who are suggesting with all of their level of seriousness, that James Harden showed up to training camp and played games in the NBA wearing a fat suit. Yeah, they say that James Harden showed up at training camp, played the first few games with the Rockets before being traded overweight, not because he didn't care, but because he was wearing a fat suit. They said that this man was overweight and out of shape, and then gets traded from the Rockets to the Nets, and within a week or two, the man is in shape and is playing great. And they don't think that that's possible. They think that that man was wearing a fat suit. That is absolutely hilarious to me and crazy. I can't imagine that that could actually be true or possible. But, yo, if it is, if James Harden was so conniving and wanted out of Houston so badly that he actually wore a fat suit and played in professional basketball games wearing a fat suit, that's hilarious. I think the reason why he was not in shape and then when he went to Brooklyn, he pretty quickly was in shape, is because when he got to Brooklyn, he was motivated. And he's a world-class athlete. And so when a world-class athlete is motivated and starts running and starts exercising, they get into shape pretty quickly. I remember about 5 years ago, Conor McGregor had two fights in the UFC. The first fight, he fought at like 145 pounds. And then like, what, 5-6 months later, he had a second fight and he fought at 168 pounds. And go look this up on the internet. The two pictures side by side of Conor McGregor at 145 and then a few months later at 168, it looks like two different people completely. I mean, it's a muscular, skinny but muscular Conor McGregor in the first fight, and in the second fight, he looks like a heavyweight champion of the world. And so the point is, when a world-class athlete, when someone who is a professional that has all the means, all the resources, focuses on their body, you can see amazing turnarounds quickly that is not possible for us. I don't think that James Harden wore a fat suit. But, yo, it's a fun thing to think about. By the way, did you see the New York Knicks fans go crazy in the streets outside of Madison Square Garden last week? The New York Knicks hit 500 for the first time in years. And then they won a game. They went one game over 500. They had a winning record at this point in the season for the first time in quite a while. And the fans were lit. I mean, like, litty. The fans were outside of Madison Square Garden in the streets celebrating, hugging each other in the middle of a global pandemic, violating all the COVID rules. They ain't care about it because they Knicks had a winning record. And Shotty, that's hilarious. That's hilarious. Our next story in the world of sports, girls' high school basketball coach suspended after team's 161-2 win. Y'all heard me right. A girls' high school basketball coach was suspended two games after his team, Arroyo Valley High School, beat the Bloomington, California high school team 161-2. That is a lot of points by which to win a basketball game. People shouldn't feel sorry for my team. They should feel sorry for his team, which isn't learning the game the right way, Bloomington coach Dale Chung said. Arroyo Valley head coach Michael Anderson said that he was suspended by the school after the game. No relation. It's hard to imagine how a game could get that out of control. Anderson said that he and Chung talked before the game, and Anderson made it clear that he wanted his team to get a full half of good play in as a tune-up for Arroyo Valley's next game, all of which he said Chung agreed to. Anderson then had his team run a full-court press for the entire first half, a half that ended with a score of 104-1. Yo. It's unclear why Anderson didn't think that when his team got up by 60 or so, he could maybe take a foot off the gas. Only in the third quarter did Anderson take his starters out and instruct his players not to shoot until there was less than 7 seconds remaining on the shot clock. The referees also went with a running clock in the fourth quarter as they couldn't any earlier in the game by state rules. It wasn't a good feeling, Anderson said to the Orange County Register. It's not something I'm proud of. It's not something that I would put on a mantle. Yo, 161-2? This man's team won 161-2. And I don't think the man should be suspended. I think that's a little overboard. That's a little crazy. You can't suspend a team for being too good. That's just, we're getting into the realm of participation trophies. But do you have to do a full court press when you're up by 60 points? I get preparing for the next game. I see what you're doing, Coach Anderson. I know y'all talked about it before the game. But, hey, if you're up by 60 points in the second quarter, Shotty, maybe don't full court press. So the other coach, Coach Chung, I don't know what he's talking about. The other team's not learning the game the right way. It appears that they are very good at the game. Maybe your team is not, in fact, learning the game the right way because they can't score more than 2 points. I'm pretty sure me and Meemaw could get on the court and score 2 points. Right, Meemaw? She's going to text me off. She's going to be like, yeah, we got this. Meemaw, watch basketball now. Meemaw know the game of basketball. And your boy got a good jump shot. Like, we could put up, you know, at least 10 and a half. Me and Meemaw. Against the other five, we putting up 10 and a half. I don't care if they full court presses. Meemaw, inbound the ball to me. I'm headed up to court. Let's go. But, yo, 161-2. I hadn't seen a score like that in years. Kind of crazy that the coach got suspended. That should not happen, but neither should 161-2. Coach Chung should be very, very, very disappointed in his ability to teach the game of basketball. And Coach Anderson, no relation. Maybe don't press. Maybe don't press. For our last story in the world of sports this week, we are going to release our In the Shed with Wes SEC football head coaching job rankings. Yeah. So this week I was in the car driving home from work one afternoon, and I was listening to some sports talk, and they had a columnist on there that had ranked the SEC coaching jobs. So, in other words, which job is the best job to have? If you are a free agent football coach, you're going to be hired by a school in the SEC. Where do those schools rank as far as which job is the best job to have, which job is the worst? And I got to be honest with you, I was pretty disappointed in the man's rankings. I didn't think that they held much water. I didn't much appreciate his reasoning. And I thought that here on In the Shed, we could do a better job. And so we have. And now I will share them with you. I look forward to hearing your emails about it. Our SEC football head coaching job rankings. We'll start from worst and we'll move to the best. Number 14, the worst head coaching job in the SEC. I think we can all agree the Vanderbilt Commodores. I root for Vanderbilt because they're terrible and because they're always terrible. It's a hard place to win football games. They have a lot of different disadvantages when it comes to recruiting. It's a lot harder to get into Vanderbilt than most SEC schools, and it makes it a tough place to win. They don't have quite the same facilities, quite the same commitment to football. They're on the low end of the totem pole. They're number 14. Number 13, South Carolina. South Carolina has tasted some success in recent years, going back to Steve Spurrier and Lou Holtz. Will Muschamp, who was there, never quite could get over the hump and lost his job during the offseason. They've brought in Shane Beamer, who's looking to turn things around. South Carolina definitely has a fan base that is passionate. They definitely have a stadium that I think is a pretty good one when it comes to SEC football. But that's about it. They're right there by Clemson. They don't have a strong recruiting base, and they really struggle to get over the hump in the SEC East. They've been knocked down a few pegs, and I have them at 13. The number 12-ranked job in the SEC, the Arkansas Razorbacks. Arkansas does have a little bit more history than the other two schools behind it on the list, but they have not tasted success in quite a while. Under their last two head coaches, before the current coach now, they really have reached an all-time low. The coach that came in from Wisconsin, who is now at Illinois, he did not have very much success there. And Chad Morris only made things worse. Arkansas showed some promise this last season. I think that they're headed in the right direction, but they're number 12 on the list. Number 11, Mississippi State. Mississippi State does not have the history, does not have a very great stadium or atmosphere. The cowbells are annoying. They don't have much history of success. They've been on the low end of the totem pole for years. At least with Mike Leach, things are going to be interesting. I don't know that he'll have success there. And if I was a head coach, I would not be looking to go to Mississippi State. 10 on the list, Missouri. Missouri is one of the two newest schools to join the SEC along with Texas A&M, and they have had some success even making the SEC championship game, but it has not been sustained. They have a new head coach in Eli Drinkwitz. I think that he's a good, exciting young football coach. I think that they're headed in the right direction. They have a chance to have a good season this coming year, but in looking at the overall landscape of SEC, I would put them at number 10. Number 9 on the list, the University of Kentucky. Kentucky, famous for its basketball, has never been much of a football school, but up until this season, they have experienced some consistency in recent years, making bowl games and being on that second tier in the SEC East. They've had good defenses. They've produced NFL players, and I think that they have a chance to kind of reach that next step under their coach, Coach Stoops, and I think that they are a school that has moved up in recent years. I have them number 9. Number 8 on our list, Tennessee. Tennessee is a mess. Tennessee is a mess now. They were a mess under their last head coach. They've been a mess for a while. The last two hiring processes have been nightmares for their university, and really they haven't experienced success since 1998 when Peyton Manning was at the school. Peyton Manning and T. Martin. Since then, they have not experienced success. They're one of the more prominent schools in the SEC. They do have history. They have an awesome stadium, an awesome atmosphere. They have very, very, very passionate fans. But it's not a place that you'd want to be right now if you're looking to accept a head coaching job, especially with NCAA sanctions on the way. I have them at 8th on the list. At number 7, I have Ole Miss. Ole Miss is in the same state with Mississippi State, but tend to be a little bit better of a job. Their facilities are better. Their history is better. Their fan base is more supportive, in my estimation. Lane Kiffin has things at a level there where there's at least excitement around the program again. Even when they've been through tough times and NCAA sanctions with and after Hugh Freeze, they have never lost the support of their fans. I think that that's a place that has an opportunity to be successful every 2 or 3 years, to have a really good season, to recruit well, and I have them at number 7. Number 6 on the list, Auburn. I am an Auburn fan, but I can't rank them any higher than 6th on the list because they're in the same state as rival Alabama. They have to compete every day with the greatest football coach that college football has ever seen, with the greatest program that college football has ever seen. Auburn has the players, they have the talent, they have the facilities, but they also have a problem when it comes to their boosters, who continuously meddle in the program. They have a history of not allowing their head coach to call the shots, to do his own thing, to run the program as he sees fit, and that gets in the way of their success. So if you are a head coach and you're looking for a job, Auburn is an attractive job. You can win championships there. In the last 10 years, Auburn has won a national title, has made a national championship game. Not many other schools can say that, but you're in the same state as a school that can say a lot more, and so Auburn is number 6 on the list. And now the top 5 SEC coaching jobs. Number 5, Texas A&M. Texas A&M one spot ahead of Auburn for the sheer reason that they are in one of the most fertile recruiting states in the country, along with Florida and California. There's so much talent in the state of Texas that even with the Texas Longhorns and a lot of other Division I programs close by, Texas A&M can do decent in their own state and be stacked. Texas A&M has a stadium with 100,000 fans. It seats more fans than almost any other stadium in the SEC. They have a passionate fan base. They have a tradition there and a history, and I have them ranked at number 5. The number 4 job in the SEC, Georgia. Georgia is a team that has, for the last several years under Kirby Smart, been right on the edge. They've come within a few seconds in overtime of winning a national championship game. They've played in the SEC championship several times, but they can't quite get over the hump and win a national title. Georgia has recruited better than almost anyone else in the country. It is a great job, but I haven't ranked at number 4. Number 3, Alabama. Now, you might be hearing that. You might think, how in the world can you rank Alabama not first, not second, but third? And the reason is because we're talking about best head coaching jobs. We're not talking about the best program. We're not talking about the most talent. We're not talking about the place that's easiest to recruit. We're not talking about the best tradition. We're talking about the best head coaching job. And if I am a head coach and I get my pick of any school in the SEC, I'm not so sure that I want to go to Alabama. A, who would want to follow Nick Saban? Who would want to go to that school after the greatest coach in all of the history of college football? Who would want to take over the job where the expectation every single year is that you win a national championship, and if you lose more than one game, it is a disappointment? You also have to consider that they play in the SEC West, which is the toughest division in all of college football, and that they have an in-state school that also is capable of winning national championships right across the state in Auburn. So Alabama, no doubt, is a great job, no doubt is the best program in college football, no doubt has the most rich history and the greatest football coach of all time at the helm currently. But if we're talking about the best jobs, I rank it number 3. Number 2, LSU. LSU is a school much like Texas A&M that has a phenomenal opportunity when it comes to recruiting. Louisiana is not there with Texas, California, and Florida, but it's not far behind. Just by recruiting their state, they can stockpile their team for years to come. With NFL talent, they do so every year. And they have something that a lot of schools don't. They don't have anyone else in their state that they're competing against. They don't have another school that they have to recruit against or worry about. They play in the SEC West, which is tough. They play against Alabama and Auburn every single year, which is tough. However, their expectations also aren't quite as high as a school like Alabama. So I think the LSU is the second best coaching job right now in the SEC. And the best coaching job, in my estimation, in the SEC is the University of Florida. Florida has experienced sustained success under Urban Meyer and under Steve Spurrier. Both of those coaches have shown what is possible at Florida. It's a place where you can win multiple national championships. It's a school where all you have to do each year is overcome Georgia, and you have a chance to walk into Atlanta for the SEC championship game. Florida has the opportunity to recruit like no one else in the SEC in their own state. Florida has all the facilities. They have the history. If I'm a coach, Alabama is already a made program. Georgia is right on the cusp. LSU has been there before. But if I'm looking at what job I would like to take, if I had all 12 jobs open to me, I would choose the Florida Gators. What do you think about those rankings? What are your top two or three or five jobs in the SEC? How would you rank things? Let us know. Email the show at intheshedwithwes@gmail.com. Let me know where I'm wrong, where I'm right, and what you think about those rankings. And before we move on from the world of sports, did y'all see what Baker Mayfield said? The quarterback for the Cleveland Browns tweeted, "Almost 100% Em and I just saw a UFO drop straight out of the sky on our way home from dinner. We stopped and looked at each other and asked if either of us saw it. A very bright ball of light going straight down out of the sky towards Lake Travis. Anybody else witness that?" We're about to move on to the world of the paranormal, but I thought that I would share that. Very interesting, especially with the articles that we have shared about UFOs in the last few weeks, with fighter pilots seeing UFOs in the sky, with airline pilots seeing UFOs in the sky, and with the admission, seemingly, of the government that the things that we are seeing are, in fact, being studied and looked into by them as well. Very interesting. That's all for the world of sports. Now, let's move to the world of the paranormal. For our first story in the world of the paranormal, we go to the CDC. The CDC offers zombie preparedness tips in case Nostradamus was right. French philosopher and prophet Nostradamus reportedly predicted a zombie apocalypse for 2021. But fear not. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention has your back with a set of zombie preparedness tips it has maintained for a full decade. Wonder why zombies, zombie apocalypse, and zombie preparedness continue to live or walk dead on a CDC website? Asks the guide, which was developed in 2011 as a marketing gimmick. Or was it? And an attention-grabbing one at that. As it turns out, what first began as a tongue-in-cheek campaign to engage new audiences with preparedness messages has proven to be a very effective platform, the guide continues. We continue to reach and engage a wide variety of audiences on all hazard preparedness via zombie preparedness. If, as the interpreters of Nostradamus' yearly horoscope believe, a zombie invasion is nigh, then it will be a great told-you-so moment for the CDC. The CDC's zombie preparedness guide has quite the graphic poster. Few young people, half dead to give a start, the 16th century astrologer wrote, ominously adding, fathers and mothers dead of infinite sorrows, women in mourning, the pestilent she-monster, the great one to be no more, all the world to end. To prepare for that bloody flesh-eating worst, the CDC page links to various zombie preparedness products, including a downloadable zombie preparedness graphic novel, a printable poster of an undead-looking, leering person with very dirty fingernails, and tips for educators looking to plan zombie-related lessons. The CDC's zombie preparedness page has been an internet Easter egg since 2011. The bizarre page on the otherwise dead serious site was published in May 2011 after the CDC's head of communications became concerned about the agency's reach and decided the agency's first ever post to Twitter and Facebook should be fun. Because a zombie apocalypse is fun? Yo, maybe in 2011 a zombie apocalypse was fun. In 2021, we don't need to be playing about that kind of thing. Like, what else could we possibly experience? We've had hurricanes, we've had a worldwide pandemic, we've had safer at home orders, we have to wear masks from day to day, we've had a time where food was not on the shelf and where we could not find toilet paper. Now is not the time, CDC. Now is not the time to be joking with us about a zombie apocalypse. We were thinking about hurricane season, which begins the 1st of June. I think about hurricane season, and we put out the same messages every year, and I wonder if people even see those messages, CDC Rep. Dave Daigle told The Atlantic at the time. We have a great message here about preparedness, and I don't have to tell you that preparedness and public health are not the sexiest topics. The page proved so popular that it tripled traffic to the CDC's site and crashed its server. Actual zombie preppers, however, were critical of the CDC's advice, saying that it fell short in a specific way. That was one of the first things we got from the zombie crowd. What weapons do you guys recommend? Daigle said. Remember, we are a public health center, so we're not going to recommend weapons. We'll leave that to law enforcement. You leave that to law enforcement. You mean Sheriff Rick Grimes? Is that a The Walking Dead reference right there? You'll leave weapons recommendation to law enforcement. CDC, what are you doing, Shouty? What are you doing? Everything on your website is serious, and you're going to put out some zombie preparedness guides, and we're not supposed to take that serious? But we're supposed to listen to everything else you say about everything else and take it serious, but not the zombie preparedness? I don't find that funny in 2021. I don't find that funny at all. And Nostradamus, if that man is correct and we have to experience some undead, living, walking dead type stuff in 2021, I blame you, CDC. I blame you. Our second story, scientists achieve real-time communication with lucid dreamers in breakthrough. Humanity has been able to reach distant vistas such as the moon, the deep oceans, and the wild expanses at Earth's poles. Now, scientists have made a new breakthrough in the exploration of a very different type of frontier, the hallucinatory world inside dreams. An international team of researchers was able to achieve real-time dialogue with the people in the midst of lucid dreams, a phenomenon that is called interactive dreaming, according to a study published on Thursday in Current Biology. Participants in the study were able to correctly respond to questions such as simple math problems while they were deep in the throes of REM sleep. The research reveals a relatively unexplored communication channel that could enable a new strategy for the empirical exploration of dreams, the study reports. There are studies of lucid dreamers communicating out of dreams and also remembering to do tasks, said Karen Konkalki, a PhD student at Northwestern University and first author of the paper, in a call. But there is a fairly limited amount of research on the stimuli going into lucid dreams. One thing that surprised us is that you could just say a sentence to somebody and they could understand it just as it actually is, she added. Konkalki and her colleagues recruited 36 people to fall asleep in laboratories located in the United States, France, Germany, and the Netherlands, with the aim of entering a lucid state in which the person was aware that they were in a dream. The study included several experienced lucid dreamers, including one individual with narcolepsy, as well as people who were less familiar with this type of dream. The researchers verified that participants had entered REM sleep by placing electrodes next to their eyes, on their scalps, and on their chins. By measuring activity such as brain waves and eyeball movements, sleep experts can determine if a person has entered deep sleep state. Some of the participants were asked to confirm that they were in a dream with a prearranged ocular response in which they move their eyes in a specific light-right pattern, left-right pattern. That's creepy. These eye signals, along with facial contortions, were used as a means of communication during the sleep sessions. For instance, the researchers asked a 19-year-old American participant to subtract 6 from 8 while he was in a lucid dream, and he correctly signaled the answer 2 with 2 eye movements from left to right. When asked again, he repeated the correct answer. Yo, he answered with his eyes? Yo. Roughly 18% of the trials resulted in this level of clear and accurate communication from the dreamer. 17% produced indecipherable answers, 3% ended with incorrect responses, and 60% did not provoke any response at all. It's amazing to sit in the lab and ask a bunch of questions and then somebody might actually answer one, Konkalki said. It's such an immediately rewarding type of experiment to do. You don't have to wait to analyze your data or anything like that. You can see it right there while they're still sleeping. What's more, many participants were able to recall the interactions with the researchers after they woke up, with individuals reporting that the prompt sounded like a voiceover narrator on a radio speaker that was clearly coming from outside of their dream. I bet that was cool. I bet that was cool. It sounded like you're in a movie, you got a narrator doing a voiceover, and you hear it, but it's coming from someone else, from somewhere else. We've all had the experience of waking up from a vivid dream only to feel as if the fragmentary details are rapidly receding into our waking minds until we can no longer recount its events. Along those lines, some individuals remember different questions and answers after they woke up than the ones that they received or gave in the dream, highlighting the difficulty of accurately reconstructing dreams once a person is awake. The team plans to build on this study with more experiments that will probe the possibilities of two-way communication with lucid dreamers. We've thought of so many experiments that we could do with this, Konkalki said. I think one predicate that we're working on now is, how can we optimize the procedure? How can we have this happen more? How can we have people have more lucid dreams? How can we communicate more reliably? We have a lot of different ideas, she concluded, and we're excited to test them. Okay, so that's pretty interesting. They're communicating with people who are in REM sleep, asking them questions, giving them prompts, and those folks can reply correctly. But when some of them wake up, they remember different questions being asked. The creepy thing here, the element that is a little bit confusing, what is this going to be used for? What is the purpose of being able to communicate with people who are completely asleep? What are you going to try to get them to do? And yo, I think I could have saved you a lot of time and a lot of money. You ain't have to get all them people in all these countries to go to sleep. You could have just come to your boy house. You could have just come to my bedroom. Because, hey, real talk, I be talking to my wife in my sleep all the time. And she be asking me questions, and I be responding to her. And I be saying things out of my dream and also replying to her at the same time. So, yo, you didn't have to do the study. It's cool. It's cool. You could have just come here. You could just come to my house and done it for free. This is another instance of scientists that are studying something that is kind of neat, but a little bit embarrassing to talk about, right? Like, again, let's use the example of the scientist being at a bar talking to someone about what they do, and they're like, yo, you're a scientist? That's really cool. What kind of studies are you doing? Well, I watch people sleep. Creepy. That's creepy. From the world of sleep to the world of hip-hop we go for our next story. Kodak Black responds to people saying he's actually a clone. There's only one Kodak Black, and he wants to make sure that his fans don't second-guess that. During an Instagram Live on Saturday, the MC addressed rumors that he hadn't been himself lately. After former President Donald Trump commuted his prison sentence, Kodak soon became the subject of speculation that he was actually a clone of his real self. The rumor stems from the Florida rapper leaving prison with longer hair, a skinnier build, and a bit of a fresher sound. The internet ran with it, and Kodak wasn't too thrilled. Why this don't sound like Kodak? What the bleep? So who I sound like? All this little clone bleep starting to make me mad now, Kodak said on his live. See, back then, all my other little bids, whenever this little clone stuff came out, I wasn't really tripping. But y'all blowing me up now. Clone accusations toward artists aren't new territory. Back when Gucci Mane wasn't released from prison in 2016, fans began to speculate that the rapper, who came out more ripped than usual, wasn't the real Guap. Of course, all of that was unfounded. These types of clone rumors extend past those who serve time, like in the case of Eminem, and sometimes take on a life of their own outside of hip-hop, such as the conspiracy that Paul McCartney died decades ago and was replaced with a clone. In Kodak Black's case, fans began speculating that he wasn't the real Kodak when he posted a jail photo on Instagram back in July 2019. He looked a little bit different, but Kodak has gotten tired of the rumors. You can't bleepity bleep duplicate this bleep, Kodak said. All kind of blank be trying to imitate this bleep. That's why they mad that I came. Bleepity bleepity this bleepity bleep. Oh, bleepity bleepity bleep. I hope you could keep up with that, even with all of my editing that I was doing there. Since he was released, Kodak has dropped two singles and offered to pay college tuition for the children of FBI agents who were killed in Florida. As for where he's at legally, Kodak still has a pending case for alleged criminal sexual misconduct in South Carolina. So Kodak Black is mad that his fans think that he is a clone. And the funny part about this is that the fans think he is a clone because he came out of prison looking different than he went in. And do you not understand that prison might change you a little bit? He came out skinnier and with longer hair, probably because, you know what, the food and the nutrition in prison ain't what it is on the outside. And probably his hair is longer because, and I'm just guessing, I'm just saying, maybe on the inside, he ain't get as many haircuts. Or maybe he's a clone, I don't know. These stories about celebrities being clones are pretty funny. Not much to this one. Although the Paul McCartney one, if you haven't heard of that, that one actually is pretty interesting, and we'll probably cover that one on the show at some point. And for our last story of the night, let's take a deep dive into the world of vampires. Fact or fiction, are vampires real? It's not your imagination. Vampires are everywhere. They're in vampire movies and all over television. They're the subject of countless books. And whether you craft your own DIY vampire costume or choose to buy a store-bought costume and add your own makeup, it's fun to wear a cape while you happily hunt for your favorite candy every Halloween. For the real vampire enthusiast, there's even a booming vampire tourist industry if you've got the money and inclination to travel to Romania and beyond. While even the most ardent vampire admirers recognize vampires as fictional beings, there was a time when people had real fears about falling prey to these children of the night. Long ago, way before the days of emotional debates on the merits of Team Edward versus Team Jacob, people devoted a lot of time and energy to keeping their families safe from these bloodsuckers. And as you will discover in our guide to all things vampires, the creatures of the night are still having a very real impact on people's lives today. With nearly every culture having its own type of vampire myth, it's hard to find the exact time the idea of a vampire was created. But to get to the origin of the modern vampire legend, you have to go back to 15th century Romania to Vlad Dracula, also known as Vlad the Impaler. While Vlad was a killer, he wasn't a vampire, but he did inspire author Bram Stoker to name his now famous vampire character Count Dracula in his 1897 book. Throughout the centuries, there have been a number of vampire scares, often tied to widespread disease like the European plagues or misunderstood physical deformities. In his book, The Dead Travel Fast, Stalking Vampires from Nosferatu to Count Chocula, Eric Newsom posits that the people's belief in vampires helped them define things that they didn't understand and couldn't explain, namely death and disease. Today, some of the more prevalent vampire myths can be explained with science. The fear from long ago that the dead could still harm the living was only intensified when dead bodies were exhumed and appeared to have blood coming out of their mouths. Without an understanding of how the body decomposes in what's known as purge fluid, it's easy to see how people could assume that their loved ones had come back from the dead and were drinking people's blood. Many early skeletons from the medieval times have been found with bricks or rocks filling their mouths or sickles around their necks, all the better to prevent these dead folks from rising up and attacking. Some have also suggested that vampires were really just people who suffered from porphyria, a condition that makes a person sensitive to sunlight. People with this disease are relegated to the indoors because exposure to light can lead to disfiguring blisters. Daily blood transfusions are sometimes needed as well. In a time of limited understanding, folks were terrified that they could catch this condition. We may have science on our side now, but vampires have only grown more popular as time has gone on. From books to cereal to a booming tourism industry in places like Romania and Forks, Washington, we can't seem to shake our fascination with vampires. How many of us can say that we learned our counting skills from Sesame Street's The Count? Or had parents who never missed an episode of Dark Shadows or The Munsters? And didn't we all sneak read the Anne Rice books way before we were ready for them? With so many appearances by vampires in our childhood, it's little wonder that we can't get enough as adults. But what about real vampires? Guys, there are more than 5,000 people out there who actually consume human and animal blood. The condition of craving blood for energy, also known as hepatomania, is real. The difference here is that these folks drink from willing donors. They don't want to be confused with the scary portrayals of vampires. These real vampires are often just average people with unusual tastes. Some choose to live in like-minded communities. Most are fairly private about their taste for blood for fear of getting confronted by people with wooden stakes, garlic, silver bullets, or fire. But with organizations like Atlanta's Vampire Alliance popping up, there's a growing advocacy for those that pursue this lifestyle. So with that, there's only one thing left to ask. Do you believe in vampires? As a part of our deep dive into the topic, we go from that to an article we found from Vice entitled, "We Spoke to Two Real-Life Vampires About Blood, Lust, and Hunger." Vampires are real. They don't sparkle in the sun, but they will get sick if they don't feed, and their skin is probably better than yours. Real-life vampires are public speakers, computer programmers, and artists who may be sitting next to you on your morning commute. Because we're a bunch of prudes, they're scared of disclosing their vampire status to doctors, who are encouraging the public to become more accepting so that these vamps and their donors will discuss their blood exchange with their physicians. To learn more, I went vampire hunting. I met Galatia, a 29-year-old Sang vampire from London who goes through a nasty bloodthirst if she hasn't fed. Sang is slang for sanguinary, meaning that she feeds off of real blood, unlike energy or psychic feeding vampires. Many people put psi vampires in their own category, however, it is a handy-dandy quick fix for those who have the ability to use this skill. What a vampire is looking for is energy, the thing that's actually carried within the blood, Galatia explained to me. I also chatted with Pixie, a 22-year-old from Seattle who is both a Sang and an energy vampire. Hey Pixie, what's your vampire lifestyle like? I have two feeding styles. The first is I'm an energy vampire. I feed off of the excess energy around me. Generally, during that, if I do it to a few people instead of a large group of people, that person or persons will wind up being lethargic. An excess of feeding on a singular person, at least in my experience, can lead to mild depression, so you always have to be careful not to feed too much from any one person. The second style is the more traditional, which is sanguinary, blood. Usually vampires only have to have one type of feeding style, and if they don't feed, they themselves get lethargic, lazy, and immobile. I have the benefit of having the second feeding style, so that doesn't often happen to me. It's hard to find a willing victim. I hate to say victim, a willing subject, who will let you feed on them via blood, and also going through the trouble of getting blood tests done just to make sure they're safe. If you haven't fed at all, is it noticeable? Yes, it's very noticeable. It's a lot like if a normal person didn't eat for days and days and days. How did you discover this about yourself? People who are vampires all share a common point, their awakening point. It's very different from how fiction portrays it. My awakening point was about 5 years ago. I woke up in the fridge tearing into a package of raw bloody hamburger. It was pretty shocking to me. I had no knowledge of this prior to that. How did you become involved in the vampire community? I am truly a child of the digital age. I do research on the computer and I found other people who also had this issue. I was hesitant to call it vampirism at first. I was scared of what people would think. You're confused, or you're living out a fantasy, or the internet went on a long way to finding people who had similar experiences to me. Tell me about the process for finding a donor or a victim, and then the process of obtaining their blood. What is the etiquette? A lot of people have a hard time finding a donor because of the skepticism that exists. The best thing is the internet. I found a lot of people who are comfortable being a donor that didn't want to get an STD test to prove that they're a safe donor to feed from. There are a couple methods of getting it. Some people prefer to use a surgical scalpel because it's a lot easier to do safely. Some people will take more obscure methods because they don't have the money. Some people will buy lancets, like the diabetics use. Galatia, tell us about yourself. Do you consume human blood? I'm a modern vampire. I was awakened at a very early age. It's part of who I am. It's very beautiful, very spiritual. I do consume real human blood. Oh yes, I have read all the medical hoo-ha about no human having any medical or psychological need for blood. Personally, I do not care what modern medicine or the psychiatric community have to say about it. I know what I need to be healthy. I've tested the theory over and over for an excess of 20 years. I know others like me. I know what I am. I'm a vampirist. I do not prey on the innocent. I don't go ripping people's throats out. I'm quite mature with what I do. I will only drink from consenting donors. How did you discover you were a vampire? My fascination with blood began as a young girl during my first kiss. I kissed him really hard on the lips and I bit him on the lip. It was my natural instinct to bite him because for some reason I associated that sensuality with blood. Needless to say, he never kissed me again, but I was hooked and I wanted more. If you do not feed, do you experience negative effects on your health? Oh, absolutely. There is something called blood rage, which is a sanguine vampiric response to an unmet need for blood. The symptoms can include unprovoked anger, extreme agitation, unpredictability, physical pain, mental agitation, and if left unchecked, severe depression, apathy, and even suicidal tendencies. When I haven't fed, I'm an ill, sick, emotionally unstable, apathetic, hungry, disagreeable creature. It's hard getting out of bed. I want to sleep too much. I become angry and irritable on a regular basis. People have called me high-strung and hyperactive. My attention span can suck. Or I go in the opposite direction and nothing appeals to me. On occasion, I've experienced such a state of pain and mental confusion from lack of feeding that I've found myself on the floor, writhing in agony, biting and banging my wrist, scratching myself, among other types of psychotic behavior. When I have fed, I'm less temperamental and apathetic and a lot healthier. What is the process for finding a blood donor? It can be difficult to find a blood donor. The main problem is that vampires are often too secretive for our own good when it comes to finding our meals. If a donor cannot see you and know that you are a vampire, chances are they cannot and never will approach you to offer. My advice, if a vampire wants a donor, is to be more public about being a vampire. Donors cannot approach you or offer to donate if they don't know that you are one. Now, of course, I don't mean that you have to tell everyone that you're a vampire, just a few select people. More than likely, they will come to you. Do you have one blood donor or many? Donoring can be exhausting for a donor, so I try not to feed from the same donor too much. I like to keep my options open, as donors can develop an emotional attachment to their vampire and can sometimes even become possessive of them. Many donors relate the feeling after having fed their vampire to the afterglow of deep meditation. What safety practices do vampires use to make their blood safe? I'm careful. They have to get regular blood tests to make sure that they're not carrying bloodborne diseases, HIV, any of that, because I wouldn't want to catch something nasty. If the donor has no desire to get a blood test, then they really do not care about the vampire's health or their own. Are there other ways to feed than with blood? Do you engage in any of these? Any vampire who has suffered through a severe bout of blood rage knows that sometimes there is no substitute for blood. But other times, when a vampire's need is not so strong, there are blood substitutes that many members of the community find helpful, if not exactly 100% effective. Nothing works all the time, nothing except for blood. But there are some substitutes that work better than others. However, the main goal of substitutes is to prevent a vampire from becoming sick, apathetic, or falling into blood rage. I'll give you a few. Pomegranate juice, dark chocolate, blue rare steak, black pudding, Marmite. Yo, I thought that was bizarre and truly creepy. Truly creepy. I remember hearing a while back that there were these communities of real-life vampires. It was something that I had never heard of before, and I thought it was worthwhile for us taking a deep dive this week because we know of vampires in the fictional sense, but most do not know that there are actual people among us, people you work with, people you ride next to on the subway, people you pass in the park, who are living the lifestyle of a vampire. That's all for this week. You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here. I can't either. It's back in the house and out of the shed for me. Thanks again for listening to episode 007. Make sure to subscribe, like, share, and review. It really does help. If you have any paranormal experiences, opinions about sports, or politics that you'd like to share, you can email the show at intheshedwithwes@gmail.com. Again, that's intheshedwithwes@gmail.com. I might even read it on air. Look for us on Spotify, Stitcher, Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Tune in again next week when we'll hit the headlines, rank NFL quarterbacks, and investigate another conspiracy theory together. This has been In the Shed with Wes Anderson, the best news show in the land covering politics, sports, and the paranormal. Have an adventurous and fulfilling weekend. I'll catch you tools later. Peace out, Boy Scout. Meemaw, we made it!